All right, welcome, friends, to the mentality of combat sports. Is that what we call it?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. David Mullins. David Mullins MMA on Twitter. Robin Black, MMA on Twitter. I got my JRE mug. We got some Bruce Lee stuff here. But you'll notice we also have this book. And on the screen in the back, we have Coach Kavanaugh, our first guest, right?
Yep, first guest.
All right. How are you, Coach?
What's up, guys? Thanks for having me on. I'll take your show's virginity.
Sweet. Well, okay, that sounds fair.
Yeah.
How are you doing? It's been, what, 10 days since Conor won that fight? You guys got to be feeling good.
Yeah, contest went very well. I'm back in Ireland now. My sleep pattern has almost returned to normal, and I have a good show on this weekend. I have a lot of guys fighting this weekend, so just getting ready for the next one.
So, David, let's start with you. We got to talk to John about some of the build-up, some of the process, what they did throughout in preparation, what they changed. What thoughts do you have for Conor?
Yeah, I mean, it was, like you've said, since the fight, it was great to see the work that you put in and the build-up pay off with the performance and having to dig deep in those last rounds and all the cardio work pay off. It was a different approach, though, compared to previous fights where you're pretty much tailoring a camp around Nate. How different was that for you?
Yeah, it's my first time doing it that specific. Of course, no matter who you're facing, you're going to have a bit of a look at them, see what stance they take, see what kind of style of fighting they bring. But never to the kind of level of scrutiny that we did for this one. We were pretty obsessive about it, you know. By the time it came around, I described it as it was sort of felt like, you have an exam coming up, but you've seen the exam questions. You got a sneaky look at the teacher's questions, so we could prepare for what was coming. So it's been a learning process for us. We changed things around with our, the physical approach, the cardio, how we literally how we trained, what days we took off, specific training partners. So it was a very different training camp, and I'm in this for a long time. I don't know how long Conor has left. But I learned a lot from this, and my next decade or two, my future fighters will benefit a lot from the new material and the new approach we have from this one.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Is what you did paid off in the result that you wanted? But what parts of the process now? So you learned to do things a different way. You learned to approach things a different way. Systemically, what has changed for you going forward?
Well, I realized that I think because of the guys' enthusiasm, we've been a lot of times approaching or sometimes going over that overtraining threshold. We're all a little bit obsessive here, and we all like to do as many hours as we can on the mat. But there's no point in going into a contest burnt out. There's no point. Pretty much all the times for Conor's fights, we always used to kind of joke Artem Lobov had the hardest job, because he would do nearly every single time, he would do 5x5s full on MMA sparring in the warm up. And they were great rounds, they were great to watch, but why do our best rounds in the warm up area? So this time the warm up was a lot shorter. That's just one example. I could, I could kind of talk all day about the different approach, but going into the contest a lot fresher, not being careful of avoiding the physical and mental burnout that can come with a long training camp. A lot was being made of Nate did so well on 9 days, where we're going to get slaughtered when he has a full training camp. But to be honest, I figured a full training camp would be actually harder on him, because it is difficult to avoid that overtraining. It is difficult to avoid anxiety training. It is difficult to avoid injuries in sparring in the lead up. And, he complained of injuries, but everybody has injuries going in. And it's been a very interesting learning process for us.
Yeah, it's great to see that. So I was in the gym the other day. In SBG, and I could see it already affecting some of the younger guys, the way they're talking about their approach to training and the way they're going to rest, and it's going to be carry forward and see the results long term.
I'm going to ask both of you guys on this now. Every time we have a new solution and a new approach, we're going to get some results, but we're going to find new challenges that pop up as well. And the first one that comes to my mind is if we approach it that we have to take these over-enthusiastic kids and find the way to have them train a little less, not be over-anxious, not be over-driven, how do we find that pocket to prevent them from being too lax and under-driven and under-prepared and under-trained? How do we do that?
I can only speak from personal experience. I do have coaches message me the odd time, and hey, I've got this great guy, but he's kind of losing his motivation, and he hasn't been training in a while. I can honestly say I've never had that problem. Or to put it another way, I will only really put my attention on guys who are showing up all the time. So I'm sure there probably is examples over the years where someone has started doing my MMA classes and then just drifted away. But I'm not the type of coach that's going to be chasing you. I hear those coaches, they call to your house and, you know, ringing you, hey, you missed training, where are you, and so on. But I've got so many guys that are, you know, like I said, on that verge of overtraining. I'm going to put all my attention on the ones that are positive about the approach rather than the ones that are negative about the approach.
Yeah, that's one of those things. I mean, like I said, I was in the gym on Tuesday night and the place was absolutely just buzzing. The atmosphere is incredible in there. And it's always has been. I mean, it used to be a smaller gym, but it always has been. The culture has always been great. For you creating that culture, because you're the main leader of that culture, when you're creating that, how do you know that certain guys aren't going to fit in, or certain guys are going to fit into that culture, and guys are going to lead it as you want them to?
You know, it's kind of it's an absolutely separate question, but it's the same answer. Sometimes I get asked, you know, you're worried about training somebody in martial arts and they're going to use it out in the street, they're going to be bullies or whatever. But this type of training, it has its own, it's a sort of a self-correcting mechanism, that the type of personality that's maybe a bully and someone you don't want to teach martial arts to, they don't last the first couple of weeks because, you know, you have a small girl armbarring you in jiu-jitsu or someone, you know, you out kickboxing you. They won't stick the pace. They quit. And it's the same for fighters in my experience, that the type of people I want to be around, the type of people I want to coach, the type of people I want in our small tribe, they don't get through that first 6-12 months of training unless they're of the same type of personality. Like you said, I've always been very proud that when someone comes in, they always say, wow, I'm kind of blown away. It's not the atmosphere I expected. A lot of smiling people here, a lot of friendly people. You know, they haven't got much experience of mixed martial arts or expecting a bunch of brutes. And we have a couple of them as well, but we keep them at the back of the gym so they don't scare away nice people.
Let's dig in a little bit into the 8 and 10 weeks that were leading up to this fight that Connor had with Nate. You know, we talked about, and you talked a lot about, everything that you could learn. And Connor, his attribution after the fight, like that night, was fantastic and felt correct and accurate. And you guys knew what you wanted to work on. And one element had to be, it's something that Carlos Condit talked about fighting Nick, was that you had to resist emotion. You had to be sort of detached from emotion within the fight and execute the game plan. And that was something, is there a way that you train that? Is there a way that you train that to be able to go in and not get involved with emotion leading up to the fight? Is that how do you, and I know David, it's stuff you've worked on before, but how did you guys do that with Connor?
Well, we made sure we did a lot of very accurate fight simulations. Like, you know, on our MMA sparring day, we really treated it the exact same as fight day. So what we were going to eat on fight day, how we was going to rest, we mimicked it perfectly. And, you know, we left the house at the same time he was going to leave the house for fight day. And then he wasn't one of the guys we brought in as a sparring partner. They didn't hang out together. They didn't become friends. They didn't chat to each other. And when they would go into the gym, they would get changed in a different room, and they wouldn't talk to each other until they were actually sparring. And then a sort of a stroke of luck, this particular guy we got, he actually was, he liked to do some shit talking. So it sort of just naturally happened that they started shit talking to each other. So, which is something that Connor kind of does whatever he's sparring with. Anyway, him and Arkham will talk to each other while they're sparring. That's just a kind of a natural thing. But yeah, we just tried to replicate what fight day would be like. get our fight simulations as close to reality as possible. Whereas, let's say the lead up to the first Nate fight, it was Conor, Artem, and Peter Queeley, and they're three very, very close friends, and they kind of know each other so well, and they're getting changed on the mat together, and you're putting your hand wrap on, and you're chatting about your day, and it's not the same feeling in your stomach. It's not the same approach you have on fight day, and that can be a bit shocking if you're not doing that. So on this one, I remember when he walked into the cage on the actual fight night, and he just walked over to me. You'll see it if you look. I gave him a little bit of water, and he says, "Yeah, this is just exactly what we've done for the last 5 months, basically, it just feels like gym. It just feels like another training day." So that paid off, I feel.
Okay, and my follow up to this, I know a lot of people will be curious about this. On the Thursday before at the press conference, and now I understand, and there's no doubt that selling fights and creating excitement and getting paid for it is a part of it. But by the time that somebody sort of had done something unpredictable, Nate Diaz walked out, and then they started kind of badgering friends and family, throwing things at them, a normal reaction is to get emotional, which Conor did. And you can see it when you pick up a can and hurl a can into a crowd. A very wealthy, successful human being doesn't do that for fun, because they understand that there's serious repercussions sometimes to doing it. So that told me that he had, you know, lost control in that moment and become emotional. My feeling at the time, as a fan and as somebody who is a fan of Conor and you guys and fighting, I was momentarily concerned and thinking, now, if you guys went and planned the entire time to be detached from emotion, in the first moment that things went sideways, Conor became emotional and lost a bit of control. Did that concern you at all?
I got a hell of a lot of messages from concerned people about that reaction, all right. You know, he said it himself in the past. He kind of lets himself off the leash a little bit for the press conferences and the weigh-ins, because it is inconsequential towards the contest on Saturday night. So it is where he sort of allows himself those last few moments that he will act on instinct. He will, you know, react to emotion. You know, I'm sure you've heard the line at this stage, what he said after the weigh-in face-off, where again there was, you know, pushing and shoving and screaming and all that. But compare that to his face on during the walkout. Compare that to when they got pulled into the center of the ring for last instructions. Compare that to where Nate started talking to me and started talking to Conor during the contest. So we were very much able to differentiate between where it mattered and where it didn't.
Well, and I'm going to ask David what he was thinking when he saw that too. But at the weigh-ins themselves, now that was Thursday, that emotional. On Friday, to me, that was a man in control performing. And I analyze this type of behavior now for a decade. And I felt unquestionably at the weigh-ins, that was entirely a performance, that there was no real emotion, that detachment had begun. Was that accurate?
He certainly knew what he was doing, but he like I said, I'm not giving away secrets here. He said it himself. He says it's the last time where he just lets out any last raw emotion he has, you know, that classic scream into the crowd. And then, you know, he faces off and the, you know, there's the pushing and shoving. It's not an act. It is him acting himself. That's just how Conor is. But he also knows when he walks off that stage, the next time he looks at him, the next time he faces him, it'll be, you know, all business. It'll be game plan. It'll be strategy. It will be void of emotion. Yeah.
David, as somebody connected to the gym on the Thursday night when you saw that, knowing all of this, you still didn't love watching that as a psychology consultant.
Yeah, but at the same time, there is that thing where there's still plenty of time to be able to become free from that and become cold before the performance, which, like we saw with the walkout, you could tell from the walkout even, Conor is just in the right place here,
100%.
Completely cold, ready to just put in a performance. So there is plenty of time to separate the two, like John said. John, one thing I wanted to ask you about, the third round was obviously the most difficult round for Conor in the fight. And everyone has talked since about him getting a second wind in the fourth, and he won the fourth round. But one thing, like that second wind, it's as much mental as it is physical and conditioning. And I think a part of that that's overlooked is that between rounds advice that you were able to give which was clear and kind of refocused him again. Just on that, when you're given that advice, when do you know what you're going to say? And when? How do you balance between watching the fight as it's happening and at the same time be ready to give the advice that you need to give between the rounds?
With around about a minute to go, I've already decided what I try not to say more than two things. Sometimes I, when I'm watching corners and there's eight separate pieces of advice and the guy's sucking wind and maybe a bloody nose, like I wonder how many of those eight things can he actually take in. So it's usually one positive and one negative and that's it. I think corner men can get a little bit carried away thinking they're going to win the contest in the corner. And I don't believe you can. It's nice, I'm sure, you know, and the guys have said that they like me being there, but the work is being done in the lead up to the fight, you know, at that stage it's done. So trying to change everything mid round, I don't think is a great idea. I'm just trying to calm them down a little bit. If there is a maximum two things I'm going to say, but more so just reminding them that feeling he has right now is very familiar. We had gone to that type of heart rate in on our cardio equipment and even in our sparring many, many times. So the recovery was coming. During our fight simulation, we had talked about this, that you can come back to your stool and your heart rate can be very high, and that can start a negative spiral of thinking of why is my heart rate so high and why am I breathing so heavily? But within 45 seconds, it's gone from plus 190 down to 110, 120, and back in an aerobic state. And just having the confidence that our training will pay off, will kick in. And you could see that when he went back out to round four. Round four was, well, I guess round one was so clinical, but round four was a great round as well. But, you know, a lot is being made of round three, and I definitely I'm not speaking to a hardcore 209 fan. They're only going to see round three in one way. But I would say to anybody in the middle, just watch it again with the sound off and watch the first 4 minutes and give your honest opinion on how those first 4 minutes went. And even the last 45 seconds or so, Connor has known what it's like to see somebody, and well, somebody, Nate, see somebody like Nate hurt and then really go for it in those last 40 seconds. But you hit mostly arms and he slipped most of the shots, and he knew what he was doing, putting his weight on the fence there and kind of letting his opponent punch himself out a little bit. And you see him when Nate came out for round four, he was, Connor had recovered more than Nate, and that's why he was able to kind of put it on him in round four. So although he gave up the last 30, 40 seconds of the round, he didn't really take anything too clean. It certainly wasn't wobbled at any time, and he knew that kind of rope-a-dope action that, you know, Ali did in Foreman. He knew he was going to cause Nate to, you know, blow a gasket a little bit, and we were going to come back strong for the last two rounds.
You mentioned getting back into an aerobic state by the end of that 1 minute of recovery. In this process of working for this particular opponent, you must have learned a ton about manipulating the three energy systems in ways that's going to help your fighters forever, between burning ATP and burning sugars and then that aerobic state. You must have really, you must now understand that on a high level.
Yeah, that's certainly one of the things that I didn't come from a sports science background. I lament the fact I went into mechanical engineering rather than sports science. There's a lot to it that would have stood to me. But I'm a student of the game. I'm learning. I surround myself with people who are experts in that. But by the end of this training camp, like, we knew, we start talking about beats in terms of currency. So we knew what the cost of a high kick was. Wow. And like, if he's at a certain heart rate, what a high kick versus a jab would cost us. And how long we can stay at a heart rate for a certain period of time. And, you know, Connor got to the stage where at any stage I could ask him, I would wear the watch that would tell me what his beats were. He'd be wearing the strap, but I could ask him, what's your beats right now? And by the end of it, he was getting it to within two or three beats every time. It was very impressive.
That is.
And that's huge, obviously, heading into the fourth and fifth round of the fight when he's been there so many times and he knows exactly.
You can lie to a fighter, which I don't think is ever a good idea. You can lie to a fighter sitting on the stool and say, you know, your heart rate's low now. But if they know, if they can feel where their heart rate's at, well then, I think that actually does a double negative, you know, because one, they know you're lying to them, and two, they feel even worse. And maybe they're saying, well, maybe my heart rate should be lower than what it is. So, you know, you're only fueling that negative mental spiral. But when we both know what his heart rate is, and, you know, maybe there's a small 1% ounce of negativity in there, but when I say what it is and he knows that to be true, then we both get onto the right mind frame on trusting what we've done for the last 20 weeks.
So one of the, I guess, after being here with David for a year or more now, one of the root parts of our ongoing conversation is about growth, about how to grow as a fighter or an athlete or a person, understanding growth. It's part of how I do my job, not just saying what a fighter does, but what he might be capable of doing since we saw him last. And so going into this one, I was talking with Ram Dean about it, and we said, if Nate Diaz and his people assume Conor McGregor, quote, doesn't throw leg kicks because he never had before, they would be in a lot of trouble. But we also said, if you guys made the assumption that Nate Diaz, quote, doesn't check leg kicks, that could be a mistake as well. Did you, as you were planning and preparing to help Conor grow with these leg kicks, anticipate that Nate might grow and not always be as heavy on the front leg and be capable of checking sometimes and so forth? Did you guys anticipate that?
Oh, yeah. Like, we had techniques for when he did go light on the lead leg, and which we executed quite well. And but also, there's even a thing of knowing. Like, Conor went in knowing he was going to limp out of there. We knew some of them were going to be checked. We knew it was going to be painful. But it was going to be a trade-off because it did affect the fight. You know, it did affect Nate's ability to use his jab. So there is a honest conversation I think you have to have, and saying, okay, a few days are going to catch his knee, and you are going to be sore for a few days after. It's going to be bruising, but the trade-off is worth it, you know.
Right.
So we certainly knew that you know, he wasn't going to be a sitting duck, and we brought in some very good Thai boxers for Conor to spar with. So he wasn't just kicking the leg of a boxer, he was kicking the legs of a Thai boxer that you know, he has to make the correct angle for the technique and not just wing it in there. But you know, if you're in a 25-minute fight with somebody and you're a part of the offensive techniques as leg kicks, guess what? You're going to have a sore shin and ankle at the end of it.
Yeah, that's brilliant. We made that assumption because when you're analyzing a Nate Diaz so heavily, and we hear this all the time, I think in my business, you analyze fights and you hear about analysis and I'm paying attention to it, people will often talk about somebody as a permanent thing. You know, as a fixed thing. Nate Diaz is heavy on the front leg. Nate Diaz hasn't been consistently heavy on the front leg for years now. He shifts his weight back and checks. So I figured that you guys had anticipated that. And you're talking about honesty with his heart rate, honesty with the fact that this is going to hurt, honesty with what you're going to go through. And you kind of saw that in the fight. He was truly prepared for what was coming. Things weren't surprising, even when it hurt, even when he was forced to dig deep, even when he caught shin. And that's a real powerful thing.
Yeah, no, 100%. You know, even with Conor's prediction of a second round win, you know, I don't see any harm with hoping for the best, as long as you're prepared for the worst. Mm-hmm. And behind the scenes, we were certainly prepared for the worst. And we had many conversations about this being a 25-minute fight, you know. I think it's an athlete's job to be optimistic and, like I said, hope for the best and see your best shots doing what they should do. However, you know, behind the cameras and behind the scenes, you 100% need to be prepared for the worst as well. And we certainly were.
There's a huge difference between needing that second round finish and wanting it. So Conor was like that, like you said, ready to go five hard rounds like he did. So the prediction doesn't matter as much as people make out it does.
Well, it also seems to me that because he had sort of made these predictions in such a bombastic way before, they could be used, and almost anything, the way he uses performance and speech and language can be used entirely as misdirection for an audience, for an opponent, for an opponent's coach. So I even felt it could be as far as that prediction was to misdirect Diaz, thinking he'd come out too aggressive.
Yeah, I have a feeling they thought we were going to have a similar, you know, game plan from the last time. But, you know, is win or learn. You know, one thing about Conor is whether it's losses in the gym, getting caught with a submission rolling or getting caught with a shot, and then of course losses in contests, which are obviously more highlighted. We will take away from that, and you know, one of the big lessons from the first fight was patience and understanding this guy has a supernatural power of being able to take an unending number of left hands to the head with it seemingly to have no ill effect. So we knew that shot was going to land. I thought the skill difference that we saw in round one of their first contest was similar to the skill difference we saw of round one of this contest, but we had the approach of, you know, you kind of, I'm sure you probably picked up me saying going into round two, okay, the skill difference is there, it's evident, and now we have four more rounds of that. So yeah, let's be ready for that. Whereas, let's say for example, one of the fights I watched was the Cerrone fight with Nate. The skill difference was actually very much in favor of Nate in their first round. So for Cerrone and for Greg, I'm sure that was a very difficult in between rounds going into round two, because you can't finish him. Nate's extremely difficult to finish, and there's also a skill deficit. I felt the skill deficit was in our favor, but we had to have the right strategy and to keep emotion in check.
I don't know how much time you have. I don't think it's a ton, but let's talk about your book a little bit, because we appreciate you coming on and sharing these stories with us. Why did you write the book, and what's in it? And I want to read it. Thanks for sending us one, but tell me a little bit about it.
You know, when the guy that I write the articles on the 42.ie, Paul Dollery, we really get on, we really kind of connect with each other. And, you know, I will dictate what I want to say, and then he writes it, and we have a good little team going. And it was actually his idea to write the book. And I thought maybe it was a bit early, you know, this is something you do at the very end of it all. But he said there's enough of a story now coming from, you know, a group of complete beginners training in a shed in Dublin where there's no wrestling or Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and fast forwarding a decade and they're doing well on the world stage and, you know, the most highly ranked organization. So how did that happen? How do you go from there to there? So he thought that was an interesting story. And then for myself, I do get an enormous amount of messages from people that are not fighters. They're nothing to do with mixed martial arts, or they have a passing interest in it, but maybe they're interested in how to apply the philosophy that we have here in SBG to their own lives, whether it's a difficult relationship they're going through or a difficult business they're going through or their own sport. I've had guys come to me from swimming and cycling and you know, someone did tweet me and say, I can't afford your book. Can you sum it up in a tweet? And so what I said was, what I really wanted the underlying message of the book to be was that you are going to have losses. You are going to have failures. And whatever you're doing, there's no big secret to this. But the message is not to see those losses as a reason to quit, not to see those losses to define you as being a failure, but instead to see those opportunities as a time to learn. And that, I've used that, and that's how I've gone from a 400 square foot, you know, shed to a 10,000 square foot, you know, prime time unit on the road front. And Connor's used that to go from, you know, a kid from Cromlin that got submitted quickly in his first few first losses, and to go on to become one of the most celebrated MMA fighters on the planet. And a lot of people have written to me since reading it and said that came across. There were some, you know, funny anecdotes and interesting behind the scenes stuff, but the philosophy of the book really motivate. I've had just yesterday I got a message from a doctor, which he was, you know, finishing his studies, and he was getting that message from it, that, you know, he failed some exams, but he learned from the failures, didn't see it as a reason to quit medical school, and went on, you know, to resit them and learn from the failure and went on to win in the second time. So when I get messages like that, it's very rewarding. And when I get guys in the gym stop me and saying that, you know, the jiu-jitsu mat, they get tapped out, and rather than get frustrated and banging the mat, you know, they're seeing, okay, well, what can I improve on for the next time I roll? So yeah, that's kind of where it came from, and I'm very happy to say that it seems to be coming true, and they're the kind of positive feedbacks I'm getting.
Are we going to have to let John go soon? Truth here? So, John, I'm going to quickly tell you a story. I was flying back from LA on the weekend, and an Irish guy at the airport, who is an enormous Conor McGregor fan, loves my breakdowns and upgraded me to first class. So this kind of shit must happen to you all the time.
That's very cool. I'm very happy to hear that.
But that must happen to you constantly, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, it's like I said, it's incredibly rewarding. I'm just walking down the street and, you know, I've had old ladies come over and stop me and say, you know, seeing our rise through the ranks and how we've dealt with very public failures. And, you know, even just for myself as being like somewhat of an older brother to Connor for the last plus 10 years, I've just been blown away by his approach to this whole thing. Like, people really have to stop and think about this fight a little bit more, I think. Like, let's say when I watched the Cerrone-Nate fight just yesterday, and he kind of got a bit run over in that fight, and not embarrassed, but, you know, it was a very tough fight for Cerrone, and I could understand why he wouldn't have chased that rematch, because he's fighting this guy that you can't hurt, and just puts the pressure on you and makes you feel bad. But what did Conor do with that type of adversity? He could have very easily went, oh, you know, the hell with that. Hey, he's a 170 guy. That's not my division. No, I should say he's mostly a 155 guy. But, you know, he fought him at a much heavier weight. I'll go back to 145 where he's kind of demolishing everybody. But what does he do with that level of adversity? He chased it. He harassed the management. He used any kind of weight he had in the organization to demand that rematch. At 155, no, he had to do it again at 170. And just as a friend of his, I had to just admire that level of ability to face adversity face on. And I know I'll pull on that. I know I'm going to have difficult times ahead of me. The business will go through ups and downs. And if I'm feeling like quitting on something, I'll be saying to the back of my head, hold on a second. You've seen what Conor went through there. He fought somebody that was kind of an ideal opponent to beat Conor, that won't go down, doesn't, you know, you don't want to follow him on the ground. He's got incredible jiu-jitsu, and you can't really finish him on the feet, so you know you're going to be facing a hellish 25 minutes. And not only did he take that on, he ran to that challenge, and I found that to be very
a huge part of that is that he did it immediately, because the immediate rematch is a much tougher challenge for you, the coach, and for him, the fighter, because you don't get a chance to test out the adjustments in other fights beforehand. So it's an even bigger credit to both of you guys and the whole team to be able to get it done immediately.
Yeah, and it's very important what you said there, the whole team, because of course Connor's the one getting the headlines in the gym, but, you know, we've a lot of good fighters here, a lot of up and coming fighters. And, you know, you yourself know the likes of Dylan Tuke and Richie Smolin and James Gallagher. Like, What a great story and a great attitude for those guys to be learning from. You know, they're the next wave of guys, and they're going to take a lot away from this. So the gym has benefited from it, and on the street and telling me how they've kind of pulled a little bit of positivity from this journey has been very rewarding, really fantastic.
And, you know, fans and people who are really in love with fighting and the art of fighting, They are, for a number of reasons, but if you can't look at that kind of thing and see inspiration in somebody failing publicly, being ridiculed, and then doing everything they possibly can to retake that exact challenge, learn from it, and go conquer it, if you can't, you know, see something in that, you just don't want to.
You don't want to, yeah.
You don't want to,
yeah.
You know. But thanks for giving us so much time, Coach. We really, really appreciate it, and the insight is really valuable. And thanks for the book, and thanks for taking care of our favorite fighter, and thanks for coming on the show.
I'll also I'll thank you, Rob, and I think you would have enjoyed. We did a technical breakdown yesterday of for my fight team. I do. I'll pick a certain fighter, and it was actually Nate Diaz. We were working on some of his best techniques, and I was using the Celtic cross as an example in it. So your vernacular is spreading.
Thanks, man. It means a lot to me, Coach.
Okay, guys, I'll see you. See you soon.
We'll see you next time. Thank you very much. So that was great.
Super.
Yeah, that was really cool. It was really cool of him to come on. And I know you're working with the SBG guys on a fairly ongoing basis, right? For years, right?
For 7 years now.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
And so I know we don't talk a lot about your work directly with certain people, but how do you work with somebody or a group of people that are half a continent away?
Yeah, so it's Skype is great, like we just saw.
Yeah.
and those kind of things. They do work well. I mean, I think it works best if you've met the guy first, and then you have that initial contact with him, and then you can carry on through online. Yeah. But I still get over to Ireland. I mean, I was just in the gym on Tuesday night, 2 days ago. It's cool. Whenever I go in, I just have just a line of guys coming up to me, and they just, I sit in the bench and they just, you know, in and jump in.
Do you do jiu-jitsu with them either?
Yeah. So, it's always great to get in. And me and John would always be in regular contact as well over different fighters and different things coming up. So it actually works.
Yeah,
it works really well.
So let's unpack some of the things he talked about. What anything jump out at you that needs further dissecting?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I touched on with him a little bit, that immediate rematch, because that's kind of been overlooked a little bit. Just what it was, the challenge that was being faced, because you don't get a chance to test out the adjustments that you've made.
Right.
Because the training approach was completely different. The cardio work, all that stuff. But you want to, you want to have a chance to have a little trial run, but he didn't have that. You know, he didn't have a chance to test that stuff. So he's straight back into the fire against a guy who had beaten him, finished him. So there was a lot there with it being immediate.
It was interesting while we were chatting, because I thought a little bit about people's perception.
Yeah.
And when you're the singer or the athlete or the politician or whatever, their perception shouldn't always be really all that important to you if the process doesn't involve it. But for us, just as people who really want to talk about it and share ideas and stuff, people's perception, I think, is something that we want to talk about because we want them to see it. And yet it's hard, I think, to imagine. So I'm a little tired today, for example. And the idea today of asking me to try to do the hardest thing that I've ever done and committing to it, knowing that it's going to interfere with or run your life for the next number of months, and you still might fail. For most people, I don't think they put themselves in that situation, because we look at, you know, athletes or whatever we're watching, and we don't think of them like one of us. But you have to almost imagine yourself taking on the hardest, scariest, public failure. You've been ridiculed, all that kind of stuff. And it brings me to, you know, a conversation we had before about Ronda Rousey.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen the exact same scenario here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and Ronda could come back energized, refocused. She's had different amounts of time to do it.
Yeah.
But put yourself in the situation and wonder which one of those you are when you watch, or which one of those would be easier to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, neither one's easy, because it's hard to do either. But it's an interesting thought I just sort of was having there as he was talking about people not necessarily seeing the scope of going back and risking a second failure like that.
Yeah, no, there was a lot on the line. A lot on the line for Conor heading into this one. And that's why it wasn't just the challenge of facing Nate. It was the challenge of facing the challenge itself, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And all that was on the line with it, another loss, what that would mean. And just his personality and who he is, it's hard to be that guy having lost two fights in a row. So it's a huge achievement what he's able to pull off. And it shouldn't be underestimated, really, the willingness to put in all the work that was required to get it done like that. There was no excuses. Same exact scenario, same weight class, same everything. Just a rerun, but with honest adjustments having been made in the meantime.
So somewhere along the lines, you're the kind of person, excuse me, that, you know, through development, is the kind of person willing to really put it on the line and potentially fail even worse. And so that is who you become one day. And wherever you start, you don't just wake up and become that person.
Mm-hmm.
There's a series of steps of eliminating or removing some of the consequences of failure. So a lot of us are worried about looking stupid, or worried about being ridiculed, or just naturally worried about failure and we're not sure why. How can you slowly, whether you're an athlete or an anybody, how can you slowly take the small steps to start to make that less of a thing?
Well, that happens all the time with fighters. I mean, everyone has had their first class at some stage, say, for example, jiu-jitsu, and it didn't go that well. It just didn't. It nobody walked in. Even BJ Penn, Gunnar Nelson, nobody walked in first day and looked good. Mm-hmm. You know, you look awkward. Even just shrimping, you look awkward doing it for the
first
time.
Feel awkward.
Yeah. So you go back though. So that's alone a thing where you failed if you want, you know. But understanding what it was and that there's a process to getting better. You go back and turn up again, and you keep turning up, and you keep getting better. And then you start training, you start rolling with guys, and they tap you easily.
Right.
And you come back again. Yeah, you come back again because it's just a process. And that stuff has been happening. Any fighter who's ever got to UFC top level had a first class at some stage, whether that's as a kid or whatever. So you just, you know, you realize that there's a process here. So it takes a little bit more honesty in a fight, though, when it's when it's public and there's reputation and everything like that, where training's behind closed doors and nobody really knows about it. But when you're a huge superstar, right, and everything's on the line, and you've lost. The option was there. Okay, not going to fight him again. Going back down to featherweight, and you know that was. I'll come up with some excuse about some injury or some reason why.
Or just blame, fire my conditioning coach.
Yeah,
Blame the weight. And,
those options were there, but was honest about it. Accepted his own faults in it. Excited to get in and make the adjustments. Became obsessed with it and then was able to go and get it done.
Well, and so part of what John said and part of what we're talking about now, I've kind of tried to distill it down to how just anybody who's afraid of failure can take steps to make that less of a thing.
Yeah.
And going and taking something that's somewhat challenging can be one of those things. You go and take a cooking class, you don't know how to cook, it sucks, you're terrible at it, and you go back.
But you will get better if you keep going back, if you keep showing up, if you have. What John is describing there basically with the whole journey that him and the whole team have been on is just a growth mindset.
Right. Yeah, that, really. That's all. I guess we don't need to read his book now. Basically, what he told us is it's just have a growth mindset.
Yeah, there's some funny stuff in there too. But it is that growth mindset of you are going to fail.
Yeah.
If you get to the very top, you have failed so many times along the way. But it's about how you review those and how you take your own part in that and see it honestly for what it is and go again and improve and look to get better all the time. That's one of the huge things that I'm always emphasizing with the fighters that I get to work with is how much better are you this week than last week?
So the only way to get less scared of failure and get better at failing and fail well is to fail and then respond well to it. And for a huge fighter or athlete or some of these people we watch in the public eye, they've done that a lot to get to this point. And for anybody else, just go try some things that are challenging, fail and get better at them, and eventually you're less afraid of failure.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the lines, failure, the idea of looking stupid is somehow there, or being judged.
Yeah.
You know?
Being embarrassed.
Yeah, being embarrassed. And when you are choked out, and you tap out, and your face is bloodied, and you had a great first round, and it went worse in the second, and hundreds of thousands or millions of people make fun of you on Twitter, your options are go hide or make excuses or ignore it or cancel Twitter. Or there's many excuses.
Yeah,
there's many options in your life at that point. And among them is embrace it, learn from it, be challenged by it, and go and chase it.
And be honest about the parts where you did fall down, you know, and then you can really make real adjustments. Mm-hmm. So that's it is a bit inspiring.
If, yeah, it should be if you want it to be.
If you want it to be. If you're biased and you don't want it to be, then fair enough.
That's fine. You can do that if you like. It was something I was talking to my wife about today, and I forget, unfortunately, but it was something where it says, you know, oh, I know what it was. Somebody had discussed the idea that a kid got – we were at the X. This was yesterday. And a child got lost. And I said, you know, we may all do it. And if we ever have children, they may get lost at the mall or we may lose them at the X. But that's one of those ones where you can't suddenly go, oh, my God, these security guards are terrible. Or, oh, that kid's crazy. He's only four. When you're four, you're crazy. This one is on you. And you must at that point go – what did I do or not do for this? If you leave in that point and go, these terrible security and I don't know why people, and you blame anyone other than yourself, you're not going to get better.
Yeah, that's the extreme example.
It's an extreme example. But And there may be still all of these circumstances that could have happened. Something happened over here. It was a distraction. If you search for your role in it, if you search to find what you've done wrong, no matter how small, if you can find your role, you can fix it in whatever it is. If you don't claim any responsibility at all, then you can't. There's no way to get better at it. There's no way to learn from it.
Exactly. I mean, that's a point we've kind of come back to over and over, but it is a crucial point to anyone competing in anything or trying to perform at any level. You have to be honest, and even if the main reason is the weight cut or whatever it might be in a fight,
what did you do?
There's still something else that's there, even if it's not the main thing. There's still something you could have done different. So, got to find those, be honest about them, and be okay to take the ego hit along the way.
And whether it's your kid that you lost or it's the weight you didn't make, there is something you could have done in anticipation. Now, it's not your fault you didn't know there was going to be fireworks over there that distracted you. And it's not your fault that you didn't know that you might have some kind of tapeworm or some situation. But now that you will look and go, oh, these types of things can happen. Mm. How can I plan for them and find out what other things could possibly happen in the future and plan for them as well?
Yeah, exactly. Like Conor now knew, he knew after the first fight, there's a guy out there who can just take these shots and he's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, that's
just impressive.
It's
crazy.
It's incredibly impressive.
Yeah.
And obviously Nate deserves a lot of credit here too, because it was a beautiful fight. It was a special kind of fight and both guys were, you know, part of that. But Conor learned a lot about having to make adjustments for that thing that happened that hadn't happened before. Where guys, everyone else couldn't take that power. Mm-hmm. Nate can and will. So he had to make adjustments. And that's true all the time. Like, that's true for fighters who look for guys to be broken before the fight mentally, and then there's this guy who isn't. Mm-hmm. And so then that's a new thing now. You have to adjust for that. You have to anticipate that. Ronda had it a little bit about against Holly in the build-up to the fight with Holly. I thought it was interesting when John was talking about the weigh-ins and the press conference on the Thursday and all that, the drama that happened with Conor and Nate. How Conor was still able to separate the two things, and that emotion that was expelled, he was free from that and calm by the time fight night came along, separate the two. Ronda still had the chance to do that
after weigh-ins,
after that kind of, whatever you want to call it, that explosion of emotion. There was still enough time there to be honest about what that was and what that meant.
Role in it.
Yeah, and where it was coming from, and then separate from that and become cold and just put in the performance. So that's a good point too. I mean, because some fighters in the build-up to a fight don't feel great, or, you know, they're feeling extra nervous for this one and all that kind of stuff. It doesn't mean that you don't have time still to separate from that and on fight day go and put in your performance.
So a couple things. You're Irish and you work with Conor McGregor's coach, and he was our first guest ever. And I'm very inspired by this particular fighter. So we are talking a lot about him.
Yeah.
But we will need to, or we want to shift the conversation to why this victory is so important, and that is at the root of what makes Nate Diaz special. Because if Conor McGregor knocked me out, that's no big deal. If he submitted you, it's no big deal, or anybody watching for the most part. But Nate Diaz, it's a big deal because Diaz is so special. And we saw it in that fight. We saw it in the first fight. We saw it in that fight. And the fight isn't even, like I said, it's not monumental if Nate Diaz isn't an incredibly special fighter.
Yeah, there is something truly special about both of those guys and the way they compete and the way they interact with each other and everything like that. Nate had a disastrous first round.
Yeah.
You know, completely disastrous first round, and started the second round. And he dropped twice early in the second round.
Could have given up.
Yeah.
He could have just been like, not my night, I'll get him in the third fight.
Yeah, but
that doesn't exist.
But that's not there. That's just not there. He's going to keep going. He's going to keep doing. And even towards the end of the second, he started to turn it on a little bit. And then in the third, at the end of the third especially, he started to turn it on. Comes back in the fifth after having a dip in the fourth. He's just always going to keep doing the right things. Keep going, keep doing the right stuff. Mentally, there's no break at all. Not even a little bit. That's something that people think that, oh, that's just part of who they are, the Diaz brothers, or that's part of Nate, that's who Nate is, that's just part of who he is. But he wasn't born like that. Right. You know, he wasn't born like that. That's been developed.
Nobody's born like that.
Yeah, it's been developed through years and years of, as a child or into adolescence, adulthood, mm-hmm. developing that mm-hmm. will to just keep going. And you won't break me. I'm going to break you. You're not going to break me. And the fact that you won't break me will break you. That's what he wants to get mm-hmm. done. Anyone can have that. You just have to embrace that. It becomes almost a decision that you be that kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And Connor was faced with that.
But it's not a decision that a person can make and go from zero to that.
No, you can't. You have to put yourself in those situations and you have to
go from zero to 10 to 20 to 22 to 40 to 35 to 50 and build it as a muscle and train it and develop it and nurture it and fail and push it further.
And the endurance stuff that he's doing, you want to quit. When you do a hard cardio session, there's times where you want to stop mm-hmm. and not do it anymore. You know, those points come, but when you keep going and you push past those points, then you get to understand the mm-hmm. next time that mm-hmm. I'm going to get to those points, but I'm just going to, like marathon runners talk about the wall, you hit the wall, same with any long distance kind of a thing. You get to that point and just when you keep going, that just reinforces that pattern for you, that this is what I do, I keep going. So you learn that pattern, you learn that behavior, you learn that response to that point where you want to break. And that happens in sparring, that happens in training where you're getting beaten up by your older brother or your bigger training partners, but you keep coming, you keep going, you learn that mm-hmm. response that you have, and it just gets reinforced every time, and then you see rewards from it, and it just reinforces that this is the best way to go about things.
There's a gym in London, Ontario, Adrenaline Training Center, and if we ever have sort of a weekend off together, it would be cool. I'll take you out there. Mark Hominick mm-hmm. fought Jose Aldo in mm-hmm. one round five with a swollen face in the middle of in
legendary
front of
stuff.
129,000 people.
Yeah,
and Sam Stout, who would tell you himself he wasn't the elite of the elite skill wise, but he won more fights than he lost, and every one of them was beautiful. And Chris Horodesky, who's just tough. And I trained when I was training to fight with Mark and Chris in particular, but Sam too. And they had these things that Sean Tompkins had taught them, and he was their coach. And he's very special. And every now and again, you get to talk about him. Anyone who was exposed to him and learned something from him really knows how uniquely special he was. And they now have fighters under them, Malcolm Gordon, who's a very good one, and Chris Hordeski's back. He's still in his 20s, and he's going to fight at TKO, and he's still on an upward trajectory. But there were certain truths that were just facts where they came from, that Sean taught them and they taught to people around them. I heard these things a lot. And one of them was, this was stated matter of fact to them, and they would state it matter of fact to you. If you quit in training, you'll quit in the fight.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a mantra that was said. You're training, you're tired, you go, if you quit in training, you'll quit in the fight. And they said it all the time because it's the truth.
Yeah.
It is the truth. And so we're not going to fucking beat around the bush with it. If you accept it as truth and you decide you're going to quit now, know that you're going to quit in the fight.
Mm-hmm.
If you decide you're not going to quit now, and what we're doing is training you to not quit when it's hard, those guys, Mark Hominick, that fight is sums up all of their lives.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they had a number of them, and they weren't just slogans. They were truths, you know?
Yeah.
But that one I've always found was a very good one because it didn't leave room for interpretation.
Yeah. No, it's very clear, and it's very true. But there is that counter of it that some guys would think that in a fight it'll be different because it'll be a fight. Right. I won't quit then. Yeah. It's bigger. It's more important. Yeah. But that's
it'll
not how it works. That's not how it works. In the fight, you'll be even, you know, like you get tired quicker in a fight than you would in training because of all mm-hmm. the tension and nerves and everything mm-hmm. around it. So you're actually, if you're going to quit in training, you're more likely to quit sooner in the fight.
To quit in the fight.
Yeah. So that's part that's a big part of it. It becomes a decision. It becomes a pattern that you fall into. It's interesting what John was saying too about how how you were asked the question about how do you stop guys from becoming too lax then mm-hmm. if overtraining was a thing, how do you? And it's almost like that can't be an option because those guys just won't last.
You're
those
right.
guys that don't want to put in the only problems I've ever had with the fighters that serious ones that were going somewhere is trying to curb their amount of training mm-hmm. that they're doing. If they're going somewhere and they're serious about what they're doing, you won't have to coax those guys to the gym. And, yeah. John, like he said, he won't do that. And he hasn't done that. And I've seen that firsthand so many times over the years. Where there's these, whatever you want to call them, talented guys or skilled guys, and they're not putting in the work. It's not like he's going to chase them.
No.
To get there. That's their decision. That they have to be responsible. And they'll either show up or they won't. And that's part of it as well. You know, that's part of that thing of... when we're talking about that toughness and that mm-hmm. decision to keep going and everything like that, and what makes that top level fighter, guys that aren't showing up aren't going to develop that either.
Yeah.
You know, they're quitting before they've quit in training. You know, they've quit by staying at home.
Yeah, right. Good point. Another way he put that was, I don't know if he used the exact words, but the culture or the environment or the nature of it is self-regulating in and of itself. This is our culture.
Yeah.
So if it isn't the culture for you, you're not going to like it and you're not going to be a part of
it. You're not going to last.
And that is, again, I use adrenaline. I've been in many quality rooms, their Parabellum out here has the same attitude. And most of these top gyms, if you go down to the Black Zillions, that's the attitude. The culture will weed you out themselves. It used to be back in 2008 when I went in and 2006 when I went in and wanted to fight, there wasn't that much. There wasn't as many barriers to fighting as there are now. And the barriers now are just to be in the pro room, you're going to be weeded out before you can get to the pro room if you're not really one of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we haven't talked a ton about it. I talked to Duke about it this week. But CM Punk, by this point, you have to be begrudgingly accepting of the idea that he went this far.
Yeah.
Because there's lots of time you could have just not been here.
Oh, for sure.
You know, and there's lots of time and most of the people that will make fun of him. And I get, as a fan, I'm the biggest UFC and MMA fan in the world. As a fan, it's like, hey, man, what are we doing with O&O guys that are famous just mm-hmm. doing it? So, but once you get past that, 99.999% of the people that will be ridiculing him could have never, ever, ever gone this far. Never mind without the scrutiny and the embarrassment. So whatever he does, he could shit the bed in that fight. It's possible. It's very possible. And if he did, he would be judged wrongly for it.
Yeah.
Because by the time you get there in that environment, being there and giving it your all is going to be a huge accomplishment for him.
There was I had a similar situation years ago. I don't know what year it was, 2012 or something. There's a documentary made about it. Mm-hmm. This guy, Mike Sheridan, he used to do different challenges every year. So he hosts a podcast and he does lots of, he owns an entertainment site and lots of stuff like that. But he used to do long distance marathon style runs, ultra marathons, and test himself with that and made a documentary about it. But then he decided, I'm going to have an MMA fight.
Yeah.
Zero training. Training. So he's going to have an MMA fight, whatever it was, 4 months from now. He set up a team. Owen Roddy, who's
I know him.
One of Conor's coaches. He was a great fighter himself, one of the best fighters Ireland has ever had. Mm-hmm. He was Mike's coach during the process, and I got to work with Mike a little bit during it as well, and he had different people on board. Conor was featured in the documentary, and Cahal and Aisling and John and everyone. But he went through the training. It was hard. You know, it was sparring with all the guys and all the different skills that he learned. And then he got into the fight. And it's like that thing. Like you said, he didn't know how it was going to go. He'd never had anything like it before. And in the first minute, he got rocked. The guy had some experience, had a few fights, rocked him. And he got clipped bad. And you don't know how you're going to react in a fight in that situation. I mean, you've never done it before. And this is on a big show, a show that John had put on, a big crowd. And it's that thing of what's your response going to be now? And he fought back. He fought back so well. He lost the fight, but he got a takedown towards the end of the third round and kind of finished on top and everything like that. And he's still training now. But it's that thing of with CM Punk. He's not sure how he's going to react in that situation. Like you said, he might shit the bed completely.
Yeah.
He might put in, you know, a gutsy performance. Who knows?
He's got a few things going for him. The environment in an arena – with all those people cheering and looking at him,
yeah.
he's been desensitized to the weight of that hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times.
Yeah.
So that's a really powerful thing that, outside of, you know, the average 0-0 38-year-old who's got to be put in that environment in 2 years of hard training. They don't have any of that.
Yeah.
So that's one thing he has. And then, of course, he's been pushed to a certain limit in the environment. But, I mean, nobody wants to mislead anybody.
Yeah.
But they won't hesitate to go, oh, you know, Anthony Pettis said he worked really – Anthony Pettis, if you don't understand that he would use one arm and just bounce around and knock him unconscious. Like, you need to understand that true – that as well to contextualize it. But Duke was just like, at this point – and this was interesting. You'll like this. He said at this point he's also going to – you know, wanted to – make him understand that whatever we've prepared you, you know a bunch of stuff. You know, you're a much better fighter than you could have ever been without this. But let's go fight now.
Yeah.
You know, let's not go execute moves and patterns and plays.
Yeah.
Because he hasn't, it would take him 10 years to prepare him to perform that way.
Yeah.
You're going to fight. And you now have been hit, and you've hit back, and you've been in these situations, and you're not, and obviously, coach isn't going to say this, but you're not a very good fighter.
Yeah.
But go fight now.
Yeah.
And understand what that is and cherish the chance to do that. And, you know, there is chaos in a fight. And if there's chaos in yours, that might be even better for you. So let's just go create some chaos and go and fight.
Yeah. That was kind of my advice to Mike back at a similar kind of a situation. Mm-hmm. Like, this isn't going to be a spectacular performance, or you know, it's not going
to
be this beautiful.
There's
like,
no,
there's no point in comparing to Connor
to a flying triangle.
Yeah, you have to get stuck in here now.
Yeah.
You know, you got to go get stuck in and dig deep, and there's going to be different situations that you have to fight back from, difficult positions and everything like that. But he can be proud looking back at that performance, and that's like you said with CM Punk, he's had plenty of chances to quit and stop and. You know, a back injury and I can't do it. I'd love to have done it, but I couldn't do it.
Yeah. But that would have been a perfect
He's
out.
Still there. He's still here now. What is it? Yeah. Less than 2 weeks out.
Yep.
So it looks like he's going to do it. Yep. Looks like he's
going
to step
going
in.
Going on a week out now.
And he's had, you know, the training is tough.
Yeah.
You know, so he's still
it's
there.
It's time to go fight now.
It's time to go and dig deep and put it in.
And I didn't get into this with Duke, although I did say it's got to be tricky because you want to let him know embrace the chaos or create the chaos when you can. Understand it's a fight. He also talked about him being a Chicago Blackhawk fan and when the hockey fights happen and contextualizing it that way because you're not an elite mixed martial artist.
Yeah.
You're going to go fight a guy.
Yeah.
And we taught you how to fight a bit.
Yeah.
So that's a good advice. But I said, you know, you want to be able to lead him that way without having him worry that it's like, oh, my coach doesn't think I'm good enough to have a regular fight, you know?
Yeah.
But that's the truth.
Yeah, you've got to be able to take that
and
take that honest feedback. Mm-hmm.
But should he be fighting in the UFC? That's a whole other question.
Should James Tony have fought in the UFC? Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. Yeah. Like, you know.
So that – well, let's just move that question aside because we can have that conversation and I'll agree with you no is the answer.
Yeah.
But let's move that one aside and move over to this one. By all means, if you want to hate on a guy, you can. But I think people should ask themselves, is there any chance, even just a slim chance, that you're hating on somebody because you look and go, these things are possible with hard work. If I accept that, what am I doing right now? Am I doing hard work? Am I doing something? Just ask yourself if there's even the slimmest chance of that maybe I'm hating somebody because they're going after something. And if I admit that, you can go, no, but he had all these other chances. Oh, he was famous. You don't have to fight in the UFC.
Mm.
You can just go take karate lessons.
Yeah.
You can play piano. You can run. You can take, you know, cooking classes. Am I saying by wanting to hate on that guy that by hating on him, I don't have to ask myself if I'm going after things?
Yeah.
You know, and the answer might be no. The answer might be no. There might be lots of other reasons to hate on the guy. Maybe it's his goofy sideburns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a goofy haircut. I can relate. But it could be – there's always that chance. Part of that is motivated by this is a mirror to what am I doing?
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Well, I think that applies to most haters. You know, that stuff can be applied to those.
This is an off-topic thing, but the culture of making videos. So this is a video right now.
Yeah.
We've got cameras and chase and stuff. When people do that, because I know now, because I work in media, to a certain degree, having some people hate something is desirable for the makers and the distributors of video. Because if we could have about 30% of people hate something, then some of those other people will argue with them.
Yeah.
And they'll come back and back and back and back. So there's a certain breeding nature where it's almost like we're going, well, hate is now a part of the culture, so let's engage them too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's a strange – we live in a strange place. Sometimes you don't want to think too much about it.
Yeah. No, I don't want to think too much about that stuff. I don't want to get inside the heads of those guys.
Yeah. No, it's true.
You know, I want to cut them out as much as I can.
Yeah, or try to, if there's any way, if, you know, there's 10 people who are super negative, and something you're doing could make one or two of them less negative, that's the ideal.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
You're like that. I don't care.
Yeah.
That's true. So what else do we want to talk about? We got 15 or 20 minutes on our rare chances to get together now as we both get busier and busier.
Yeah.
Damian Maya.
Yes, exactly. Okay. That's what I was going to say. Damian Maya. Because I had this chat with one of the lads in SBG, actually, the other day. And we were talking about confidence and you know, the mistake of what people perceive confidence to be versus what it is. People wouldn't, if you were to list who's the most confident fighters in the UFC, you wouldn't list Damian Maya.
Right.
The people naturally wouldn't think of Damian Maya.
Yeah.
To me, he's up there at the very top in terms of confidence because he trusts his skill set against a guy like Carlos Condit. He just trusts, I'm going to go and do what I do and it's going to work. I don't need to change too much up. I can trust what I do, and he goes and does it. The amount of confidence in yourself and your skill set and your technique and everything to be able to pull that off is huge. He's not talking shit afterwards or before. He's not
it's irrelevant
brash.
To confidence.
That's personality. That's not confidence.
Right.
People mistake personality differences, an extrovert for an introvert, and think that's confidence. The extrovert is confident. He's not. He's just extroverted. That's just a personality difference. Damian Maya is confident as it gets. Yeah.
And
but he's so confident. You couldn't have done what he did to Carlos Condit if you're not super confident in your skills and yourself.
Okay. And this is something we've talked about before, I think it bears repeating. If I happen to be confident in my skills that I can go beat BJ Penn for sure, because I boxed for 12 months in grade 11 and I'm confident I can do it, I'll just get knocked out.
Yeah.
But Damian Maya is confident because.
Yeah, it's to be confident is not to believe you're going to do it. Confidence is based on the work that you've put in. That's false confidence that you would have that you could beat BJ.
It's lying.
It's not true. Confidence is when your belief in your skill set, yourself, your conditioning, whatever it might be, matches where it actually is. So if your skill level is here and your conditioning is here and the training you've put in and the work and everything is up to this level and your confidence, your belief in those is here, same level, then you're confident.
Yeah.
You know? If it's down here, Your belief in that stuff, you're diffident. Your confidence is low. If it's up here, that space between is just bullshit. Mm-hmm. So it's false confidence.
I talked to Irwin Lacour. He's
yeah.
the movement guy. He worked with Carlos Condit.
Yeah.
And I was we were just digging in a little bit about the connection between confidence and movement. And people talk about, you know, movement being the key to physical things but if you're not confident in a movement, the movement itself may not be expressed fully.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know
that's
what
true.
I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like true confidence. There are people who just have beautiful, say, boxing.
Yeah.
But if they don't quite believe in it, it's the true commitment to that thing that is very good that makes it that good.
Yeah. They're getting their way then.
Yeah.
They're getting their own way.
Yeah. That it's sort of slight unwillingness to fully commit to some type of movement or physical expression, or even people who speak in public or any type of thing. If they're just not quite confident enough, they actually won't do the thing as well as they do it
or can do it. And it's important then, because that's kind of the discussion I was having with that guy in SBG the other day, is understanding that personality is one thing and confidence is another. So just because you might naturally be a little bit less extroverted than others doesn't mean you're less confident. Doesn't mean you shouldn't trust your skills. Are you putting in the work? Can you see what you've improved, and are you honest about the hard work you're putting in? If so, you have earned the right to be confident.
Right.
You're not just confident or not. You earn confidence through work. There's no shortcut with that. But if you have put in the work and you are improving in your skill set, then you've earned the right to have the confidence, so feel it. You don't need to be brash about it. That's not confidence, mm-hmm. but you can trust the work, like Damian Maya style. Mm-hmm. Go in and get a single leg takedown, pass, take the back, choke, finish. You know, it's the most fundamental style of jiu-jitsu, mm-hmm. but it's
and
so Carlos effective.
And Carlos Condit had spent a lifetime being entirely familiar with it, but because it's so good and expressed with such belief,
yeah.
if it's at a higher level than Carlos's ability to deal with it in that moment, it'll win.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. as we saw. Yeah, exactly. Even though you know exactly what's coming, stop it. You know, it's still on another level, and Damian knows that his offense there is going to be better than your defense, even though you've been planning for it for so long. You've been working specifically to try and stop me. I'm still going to do it. So it's something to be really admired. But that's one thing that jumped out for me, is that people wouldn't think of him as a confident mm-hmm. kind of a fighter. But mm-hmm. to me, you would naturally think of Conor,
yeah, right.
and people
yeah.
like that. Damian Maya is right up there in terms of confident athletes.
So, speaking of coaches, I was telling you I did a 5 rounds today. Ramdeen was out of town. I talked to Ray Longo and Duke Rufus and Mike Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talked to Duke, it was interesting. We're talking about confidence and about cherishing a challenge. Duke and I had some interesting conversations about Anthony, and we started talking about some other stuff like the Cuban boxing background, and we talked about CM Punk. But there was a little bit at the end before he had to go where you could hear him just so excited at the idea of Tyron Woodley fighting Stephen Thompson.
Mm, now, the challenge of it.
The challenge of it, but also his confidence that his brother was a pioneer of that style,
mm.
and his father has been a part of that particular Stephen Thompson's particular long pants point karate world, that his entire Duke Rufus's entire family tree is rooted in that.
Yeah, of course.
So to him, this challenge is one, I think we're the right people for this challenge, and two, he's so excited about bringing his father and brother in to work on the challenge together with
that
Woodley.
Puzzle. Yeah.
You know, isn't that an interesting thing? Like, you could hear it in his voice.
Yeah, weren't you excited by something like that and you've got that team around you? It's similar to what SBG had to deal with. And I say SBG because it is like a team effort.
Mm-hmm.
Had to deal with the Nate challenge mm-hmm. And knowing what that is. So, yeah, that's exciting. That's great. And when you have that outlook with it, when you are excited by it, then, you know, if Tyron has that same outlook himself and that kind of filters through to him. And
he's willing to sponge in the knowledge and he's excited to go and try it and develop it and grow.
That's a great place to be rather than, oh, shit, this guy's tricky. This guy's awkward.
Nobody's solved it.
Yeah.
Matt Brown solved it. Now it's been years and he's progressed a lot since then. But
that's a great way to be approaching heading into a fight, heading into a challenge like that. Heading into a fight is to see it as a challenge and something to be solved, something to be figured out, and then everyone has their part to play in that. Everyone in the team has their part to play in it. And then on the night, for the fighter, it's about trusting that prep and trusting that work. Like when John mentioned about Conor, all the work he put in and the way they train with the sparring partner, treating it like a fight almost, but on the night when he steps into the cage and he gets a little drink of water, it's like, this is the same as what we've done, same stuff. And then between third and fourth rounds, it's like, this is the same stuff as the cardio stuff. This is you on the Roan machine. This is, you know, you'll recover here now. So Tyron has the same kind of a thing where in the fight, he has to trust the prep, trust the training that he'll have put in, trust the work that he'll have put in to deal with that style.
Yeah, that I became a whole lot more interested in that when I kind of looked at it from his coaches and his team.
I hope that fight gets made now.
Yeah.
You know, what you said there, it makes so much sense. I really want to see it.
Yeah, because that challenge of Stephen Thompson, they are the right people to approach that challenge. They at least have some connection to it and a history with it and a family environment around it more than everybody else who's taken on that challenge.
Yeah.
So it becomes very interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
You know? So I'm definitely excited to see that. Now, I think we got about 10 minutes left. I showed you my breakdown for Stipe versus Overeem. That should be out.
Overeem's better than I even thought he was. When
well,
you
that's
that
what
stuff.
I got out of that too, from working on it and studying it, is how much smarter he's become as he has become less focused on being armored and physical and all that kind of stuff, in whatever way you want to talk about it. Did he fail a drug test? I believe
he
may
I don't
have
think he
one,
did, though. I'm not sure. So
I mean,
allegedly.
Allegedly, yeah. I mean, however you want to interpret the fact, the truth is, for the purpose of what he is now, is he's less muscular. He's less focused on athleticism in whatever ways that is. And it's made him better.
Yeah, more cerebral, more trusting in his skills.
Yeah.
Because they're there hugely.
Hugely. And I called part of it perception management. Okay. And I don't know if we'll get together next week or the week after. Next week would be before Overeem. Mm-hmm. The week after would be after. Maybe he loses. Maybe he wins. But I really found that he was controlled. Perception management, when I started exploring the idea that he was controlling what you saw very well. And if I control what you see, it's going to influence what you think. Or it may, unless you're prepared for that in some way.
Yeah.
So when I started researching that concept, perception management is something that is done by media or governments or whatever, people who want a message to get out to the public. They control what you see and how it's phrased and stuff. So I kind of connected that idea.
Yeah.
But there are moments where Overeem is literally saying, see, I'm moving towards your hand or your kick. I want you to throw it. And because you know he's intelligent, you're like, I think this is a trap.
Yeah.
And then he dips it out even further. And then you think, oh, it's a trap.
Mm-hmm.
And you do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a really interesting moment. Is it a trap? It would like to be a trap, but you can still punch and kick that head. Mm. But you choose to do nothing because he's shown you, look at this thing. I'm smart enough to know not to do it. I'm doing it. I'm daring you to do something. You choose not to do it. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel that all the time with when I'm rolling against someone who's much better than me.
Yeah.
And you get something. I'm like, oh, shit, I don't want to take this.
That's
like,
right.
There's a position
that's
to be taken. I'm like, they're only giving me – they're giving me that position because something's coming next that I don't know. Yeah. So it makes me hesitant myself in what I'm doing, even though it might still be the right thing to do.
And that's the reality. If you really – are aware of the reality that you're now going skill for skill with somebody better than you.
Mm.
And so the answer to that one, I feel, is we have to not make it about skill for skill in these areas. Like, if really I'm not comfortable rolling with you because if you go like this, I'm like, oh, God, he just wants me to take that. And then he's got something for me. We have to change the script entirely. So now either I've got to be in a position where I'm better than you, or I've got to make this fight about a different attribute or something. And so what makes the fight with Stipe so interesting is Stipe can make it about reaction time, athleticism, speed, all of these other things. And so
conditioning as well. Drag it into the later rounds.
Yeah. So – but Overeem is really smart. You see it in those two knockouts, his last two knockouts. He is very, very smart. And I don't think when people think Alistair Overeem, they often think of his brain.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely there for sure. Mm-hmm. And maybe, like you said, we've seen it more in the last few fights because that size isn't there, and that athleticism or that freakishness of whatever you want to call it is not there anymore. So he has to go back to the skills. And like we've just talked about it, Stipe can, he can see what you've seen in your breakdown. He can see the same kind of stuff and plan for those things and have a plan for how he's going to deal with, what Overeem has been doing.
When Chris was dealing with Silva, Anderson Silva, Ray and Chris were like, in these moments where he hypnotizes you, you punch him in the fucking chest.
Yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
It's when he does these things, we're going to be prepared. Some of it is just voodoo.
Yeah.
And we'll just get to work.
Punch him in the chest.
And that night, Ray's yelling, punch him in the fucking chest. But also, there's a moment where Anderson Silva does a walk against the cage, and suddenly it snapped into it. Chris is like, because they had, and it was Stephen Thompson, in fact, they had him simulate many of Anderson's exact things. So when they saw it, it's like, right, this is a thing. He had me going for a second, boom.
Yeah.
And they addressed that. And with Alistair, Two, you'd have to think you approach it the same way. You dare me to punch you in the face, I'll punch you in the face. We've examined what some of your options are. I'm committing to this. I'm taking the bait, mm-hmm. and I'm prepared. You're doing this because you're prepared to counter with something. Well, I know what those counters are, and I'm prepared to counter that with something.
Yeah, for sure.
So it starts to become like a chess match in advance of the chess match.
Yeah, and you need to be clear-minded within the middle of that chess match, within the middle of that fight, to be able to perform and best and recognize those patterns and see them. And so you need to be honest in the build-up about the emotion that is there. This is a first title defense or mm-hmm. a chance of the belt.
In his hometown.
In the hometown and all that different yeah. stuff that's there. Got to be honest about that, because Werdum had that against yeah, him right. and failed.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
He had a first title defense in Brazil. And it seemed like it was all too much. The emotion of the whole night was a little too much, and he fought a little recklessly and ran onto that shot. Literally ran onto that shot. Yeah. So Stipe needs to learn from that experience. Even though he didn't have it, he can still learn from it.
Right.
Another person's experience. Yeah. So that's going to be crucial too, to manage that mm-hmm. stuff in the build-up.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of minutes left. Any last thoughts on anything, or John, or it was nice having a guest.
It was nice having a guest. Nice, we'll get more in. With the book, I know it's available on his Twitter at John_Kavanagh. Mm-hmm. He's got the link in his bio, so it's available worldwide there.
Yeah.
The documentary I was talking about is called Barbaric Gentleman, because some people are going to be asking about that, so I forgot to say the name of it, Barbaric Gentleman. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
Following
too.
A guy.
And then next time we get together, let's gather up some questions again.
So
if you guys have questions or thoughts or ideas or counter thoughts to anything at all, hit us up on Twitter, David Mullins MMA on Twitter and Robin Black MMA on Twitter, and he's DavidMullinsSportsPsychology.com. And that was fun. It was fun having a guest. It was fun chatting. It was fun catching up.
Yeah, for sure.
So thanks so much, you guys. We really appreciate all the feedback, and we will see you next time.